Let's bring in Hannah Scott. The number of shootings in King County continues to soar. And here's Hannah with the latest on that, Hannah.
Yeah, Dave, we got the latest numbers yesterday from King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg.
The first 6 months of this year, 196 people were shot in King County. That's a 60% increase over the four-year average. That's more than one person a day who was shot in King County. Of the 196 people who were shot, 42 of them died. That's a 50% increase in fatalities. 154 people were shot. They didn't die. That's a 65% increase.
Some pretty astronomical numbers. And this, again, involves mostly young men between the ages of 18 and 24, and mostly from communities of color, predominantly Black neighborhoods.
Those kinds of programs that are community-focused, where people who are credible with youth, not some prosecutor in a tie or some police chief in a uniform, but somebody who's from the streets and from the communities can speak the language and can understand the anxiety and depression and despair that exists in so many of these communities. They're the people we need to send in to become credible messengers with our youth. I totally support those kinds of investments.
That's what he says is the primary way they need to address these types of shootings. And the good news on that front came yesterday from Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin.
I'm very heartened today to announce that the city of Seattle will be investing $2 million in the King County Regional Peacekeepers Collective. It's a pilot program that's brought together a range of community-based organizations with skills, trusted community messengers, lived experience, and the expertise to go in and mentor and help high-risk youth and their families who have experienced the tragedy of gun violence or who may soon experience that and help break that cycle.
Durkin says,
with this $2 million investment over the next 2 years, the peacekeepers will have the necessary funding to add restorative services for families, to support specialists for youth, and family support services and comprehensive trainings. Approximately 200 young people and their families will be supported in this using a public health approach and public health strategies.
Now, this has been something that we've heard a lot about recently, about investing more in some of these types of programs. This pilot program is kind of a collective of some of those community programs. One of those leading this pilot program is Derek Wheeler Smith. He's the head of the group known as Zero Youth Detention.
We're really holding two tensions. What do we need to do to stop our kids from dying tonight in the streets? While also thinking about how are we creating the conditions in community that allows for equitable quality and quantity of life. That is critical. Otherwise, we have organizations that do amazing work around violence intervention, but then they're forced to send young people back to the same environment that made them sick in the first place.
So he says it's about looking at the big picture.
Today, we are doing the work of employing strategies focused on targeted, trauma-informed care. And interrupting cycles of violence can produce life-saving and cost-efficient results in a short period without contributing to mass incarceration.
Now, Wheeler Smith says, though, that it's vital that they have the resources that they need to do this work.
One thing that is important is that as we treat this disease of violence, we have to make sure that these violence interrupters, who are really a new kind of public health worker, out in the streets, risking their lives, literally ducking bullets, that they have the best tools doing this important work of intervening, stopping the violence that's happening, but then also making sure that we have the relationship-based resources to support young people in a continuum of care, that we can bring them to a place of health and wellness.
Now, one of those major resources, the team's Dominic Davis, who heads up Community Passageways.
And the uptick of gun violence now has got a bigger focus now. Now it's made people shift their focus from other issues in the community to say, we have to stop this, the gun violence that's happening right now in our space. Our kids are not safe. Our families are not safe. Our community does not feel safe. We ask our young people, why do you guys feel like you have to carry a gun? They kind of laugh. They're like, what do you think? We all know the answer to that, right? How do we provide an environment that is safe for our children, that is safe for our families?
He says this collaboration and investment is going to be huge in that effort.
This trauma is tearing our community apart. The crying mothers, the grieving families that we have to deal with, and the trauma that we take on doing this work. So now investments are being made, which makes us feel like you guys see us. You guys are putting a focus and some attention on this. The collaboration of the system stakeholders, county and city, along with the community stakeholders that are doing this work, coming together and holding each other accountable and being responsible together for the answer of gun violence. Now it's just not the community having to put it on their back and solve the issues that racist institutions have put in our community. We don't have to do that no more. We are working with the institutions that are saying we want to solve this problem.
And he couldn't contain his excitement about that yesterday during this press conference. Oh. And that was kind of the collective. He's a very powerful person.
Yeah, I know. Well, I've heard of community passageways, and the whole idea is to give kids different choices than they had before. And it sounds like he's really pumped that this is going to work.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, he started his comments with, "We're going to end this gun violence. We're going to stop it." As long as I've been talking about gun violence, community passageways and Dom Davis have been asking for more investment. This has come together in a way where you've got the King County executive who launched this program. So now Seattle's mayor, $2 million over 2 years for Seattle.
Okay, but tell me more about this now. I mean, he said that this is a does not involve police knocking on doors or throwing kids in detention. He says that his people are going to be in the middle dodging bullets. What did he mean by that?
And they already have been. In fact, his place where he has meetings was shot up just this last year.
Wow.
He sees this front and center all the time. But what they do, these are people from these neighborhoods, right? They're out there on the street. They're walking around on the street. Their teams are people with lived experience who are from these neighborhoods who are going to get, we've talked about this before, they're going to get that interaction, that level of respect.
But is it just talking to kids, or is it because my understanding is that a lot of the appeal of the of this violent lifestyle is because of the money, right? You sell drugs, you steal stuff, and you sell it because you want that lifestyle that you see other people have. How do you address that?
Hope. Yeah. That's what's missing here, okay? So there is that aspect, right? There's that you get the bling and you get your money. And there's certainly those kids that I've met that kind of get into it for that reason. But that's because they don't think there are any other options. The majority of these kids are growing up a lot of the time with no people already assume that they're going to fail, right?
Yeah.
Or there's safety issues in their neighborhood. And that's why they pick up a gun, because they need to protect their family. A lot of the time, that's what's happening here. And it's just, that's generational. That's what's gone on forever. There's, poverty, all kinds of issues. Those are the things that have to holistically be addressed, and to a certain degree are right now. As we got this $2 million announcement from Mayor Durkin, we're also getting the $10 million investment for the investment into the BIPOC communities that she promised. And then later today, she's going to be talking about another investment for the reimagining of policing. There's a lot of stuff going on together collectively that I think is going to make a difference. But specifically on gun violence, you've got to get the hope to these kids. And it's about continuing to care, right? So you don't just talk to them on the streets and, okay, that's good. No, you take them and you walk them through the various possibilities, whatever programs are available, whether that's educational or work-related, whatever it might be, to get them on a different path and let them see that there's hope.
Well, that sounds like a reason for optimism. Thanks, Hannah.
You bet.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Our resident historian Felix Spinell joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map, which is a quick look at the stories behind local places and things. And this week, two invisible lines cross in the hills west of Portland that surveyors have used for 170 years to map all the real estate, not just in Oregon, but in Washington.
Yeah, we're talking about the Willamette Meridian. I know, not exactly a household name. It runs north to south, and the Willamette Baseline, which runs east to west. These are the X and Y axes. They're invisible, of a giant invisible grid. They cross in a monument called the Willamette Stone, which is located in Oregon State Park, northwest of Portland. I looked on the map. It's about a seven-minute drive from Powell's down there in downtown Portland. Now, Dan Klug is a head interpretive ranger. He knows more about the Willamette Meridian than just about anyone.
It's a basis for all survey that was done in Oregon and Washington in the 1850s and then successive dates as well. And to this day, everything is based off of the Willamette Meridian and its counterpart, which is the baseline. The meridian runs north and south from a point in the West Hills of Portland where they originated it, and it runs north to the Puget Sound and south to the California border.
I have to emphasize, it isn't visible. Don't go looking for it out there in your backyard. Now, it was on June 1st, 1851, when a crew working for the first Surveyor General of Oregon hammered in a wooden stake to mark that origin point for the meridian and the baseline. And coincidentally, the permanent stone was installed in 1885, which is 136 years ago this Sunday, July 25th. Now, this is part of what's known as the Rectangular Land Surveying System that dates to 1785 in the Articles of Confederation. Oregon Territory became part of the U.S. in 1848. Settlers were arriving and claiming land under the Donation Land Act of 1850, and there had to be some universal recognized system to keep track of who had claimed what. Now, this is, of course, the notion of land ownership was totally foreign to the indigenous peoples here,
right.
And struggles over the land would lead to treaty wars, the struggles over land about those restrictive covenants, all those things, the DNA of the of all that stuff is in this Willamette Meridian, Willamette Baseline. Now, meridians and baselines are also part of that system of township and range. You know, those are the squares within those big grids marked out on that giant invisible grid. So if you own real estate in Washington or Oregon, the legal description probably includes the name of who created the subdivision or so-and-so's plat or whatever. But it also has language. It's probably similar to where we are right now at the radio station, which would be Township 25 North, Range 4 East of the Willamette Meridian. And sometimes in the legal paperwork, it's just abbreviated as WM. But it's all there. I mean, this all dates back to this June 1st, 1851. These guys walking through the woods and hammering this wooden stake. And there's about 37 of these other meridians in the United States. The Willamette was the first one to be laid out west of the Rockies. And depending on what source you look at, it was either the 15th or the 17th one overall. Other ones nearby are the Boise Meridian over in Idaho and the Humboldt one in Northern California. So I talked to a surveyor yesterday named Bob Winters of a place called Chadwick and Winters. And he told me the Willamette Meridian, it's still a thing for surveyors. It's not some ancient piece of distant history. It's a fact of life for them every day. Heard the same thing from the King County Assessor's Office. This is just something that, though it's invisible, though it's been there 170 years, it's the backbone of everything that Western society and Western civilization built here in the Northwest. It all goes back to these guys in the woods with their chains and their early surveying instruments marking out the future of the Northwest.
So what if somebody just stole that wooden stake in the dead of night and made off with it?
Well, you know,
what would happen?
That wooden, that the stone that was installed in 1885, that's long gone. It got broken off. So if you go to that little park, there's just a flat spot in the ground where they put in a metal benchmark. And there's some other interpretive panels and stuff. And you have to sort of, there's two kinds of people, Dave. You either love maps or you don't care about them. And I guess you can probably guess which camp I'm in.
Well, I know. It's just that I would hate to think that my title to this property depends on some little flat space down in Oregon.
Well, see, you have to
that
use
isn't
your,
even guarded.
But you have to use your imagination because now the imaginary grid has been in place for long. You look on maps, you'll see township and range. It all goes back to this single little spot west of Portland.
Felix Bunnell. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Colleen, and Chris Sullivan. Well, we've certainly heard about the wildfires burning in Oregon and in eastern Washington. What I've noticed, though, what you've noticed, though, too, is that the haze that we had last September is nowhere to be found. So I just want to know how long our luck's going to hold out. Let's talk with Ted Beener, who for 40 years was with the National Weather Service and has covered this stuff for a long time. What do we owe our good fortune so far, Ted?
We suffered through that historic heat wave just about a month ago, and it also triggered an early start to our wildfire season here across the Pacific Northwest. But in western Washington, we have been very fortunate to have cooling winds from the Pacific Ocean, and has really kept the wildfire smoke from British Columbia, eastern Washington, or to our south in Oregon and California away from us.
So what would cause that to change?
Well, we need a wind shift of some kind. And at this point, you know, here we are in late July, and the wildfire season is very likely to extend into September. So my concern is at some point, those onshore winds will shift and we may spread smoke into our region from the north, the east, or the south.
Well, I can say that this time I'm ready because I have a supply of N95 masks, and those are effective against smoke, correct?
Oh, absolutely. They're the best. You know, we've all been wearing cloth masks for COVID or other reasons here of late, but those fine particulates in the smoke can get through those cloth masks. So the N95 masks are the way to go.
Now, there are other things you can do, though. I was surprised. You can actually sprinkle your yard, and that will help?
yeah, it helps attract the smoke particles. It's just amazing. Even laying some cups or bowls of water around your yard, same thing. It just helps to collect it, draws it there, and it's less of a chance to get into your home.
Really, like a smoke magnet?
Yeah.
You know what I do, and I set this up because we have a cedar shake roof, and around the 4th of July, when you know the neighborhood just lights up with fireworks, I'm worried something might fall on it. So I put a lawn sprinkler up there and just sprinkle the roof. Now, are you saying that that might also help draw smoke particles out of the air?
Yeah, that might not be a bad idea. Have you got your sprinkler system up on the roof still at this point?
Yeah, no, I put it up there when I was a younger man, and I'm not going up to take it down. So ladders are not my friend anymore. And actually, it cools down the house, too, on a hot day because of the evaporation, but it's also sucking in smoke particles. Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
How should regions be prepared for these heat waves, which seem to be happening on more of a regular basis? It's nice to have these little tips to increase your comfort. Do governments need to get involved in some way?
Well, that gets into the regulatory kind of thing. One promising thing I've noticed over the years is, you know, maybe 20 years ago, 10, 15% of the people had some kind of air conditioning unit in their homes. Today, it's now over 40%. And I think a lot of the new buildings, whether it's, you know, multifamily or single family homes, are now including air conditioning. And I've had a lot of my neighbors around here, they've gone with the heat pump routine mm-hmm. so that they're getting air conditioning as well. I think we're getting more and more people having air conditioning. But as you saw during this historic heat wave, boy, you went to your local box store and you tried to get an air conditioner. Well, they ran out of them pretty quickly.
The other thing I found works is deciduous trees. I got a big birch in the front yard, which keeps the morning sun off the roof. And then a giant Douglas fir in the backyard, which keeps the afternoon sun off the roof. And the house remains fairly cool. And then when the birch loses its leaves in the winter, of course, then whatever sun gets through it's welcome at that point. I find it really remarkable how much difference living in the shade can make.
Oh, I'm in the same circumstance. I live next to a natural growth protection area, so to my east, to my south, like you said, those sun angles, those trees really help to shade the house. And then, like you said, during the winter season, when they lose their leaves, you have that welcome sunshine to help warm you up, particularly at that lower sun angle.
And now tell me whether you think these heat waves are yet more of an indication that global warming is here to stay and it's too late to stop it.
I would say that the trend towards having more of these warmer and drier summers is clearly here. No doubt about that. And on the other side of the coin, you remember this past winter was the La Nina winter, and we tend to be wetter and cooler. Well, we certainly were wetter. You remember how wet we were the first few weeks of January. And just looking at the seasonal outlooks now, it looks like we're headed for another La Nina season for this coming winter, which for the mountain snowpack, that's really good news that we tend to get a rather healthy mountain snowpack. And we could use the moisture at this point. And so our typical fall rains kick in either late September or into October. And I personally look forward to that when that time comes.
Yes, well, I root for the occasional surprise drizzle like we had the other day. So I don't know if that helps, but I do it anyway, Ted.
Oh, absolutely. That was refreshing, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Ted Beener, formerly with the National Weather Service. And where can people find your posts these days, Ted?
At everettpost.com. I have occasional weather-related news stories as well as my Weather Minute podcast.
Ted, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Fascinating interview, Dave. Thank you. A 99-year-old woman and a 2-year-old boy formed an unlikely friendship across their fence during the pandemic. Carol Evan TV's Boyd Huppert has your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft.
Two houses separated by a fence. Benjamin Olson in one.
Mama.
Just turned 2.
You knocked the tower down.
Mary O'Neill in the other. Just shy of 100.
This is Yahtzee.
For more than a year, both found themselves pandemic prisoners.
A lot of just us in this house.
I'm playing against myself.
He has never really had any other friends.
Until Mary and Benjamin.
Hi, Benjamin.
Found each other.
Give it a kick. Here comes the rainbow. Here comes. We call it cane ball.
Their name for hitting one over the fence.
Wow, two balls.
His first best friend.
Stuck at home.
Yeah.
Benjamin's mom watched.
Go!
As barriers fell.
Where'd the bubbles go?
And a friendship.
Woo!
Blossomed.
Ooh, bubbles, bubbles.
Those old Tonka toys?
Mary said that she had these trucks for Benjamin.
My sons, they passed away. So they've been sitting down in the basement for years and years.
Mary also lost her husband 37 years ago. Her grand and great-grandchildren all live out of state.
Valentine's Day.
But new photos of Benjamin and his baby brother also now occupy places of honor.
They're the closest thing to grandchildren I have around here.
And as the pandemic eased its grip, Benjamin discovered.
Gonna open the fence.
The grass is even greener when you can share a friendship.
Oh boy, I'm gonna get some dirt.
Same side of the fence.
Thank you. Oh, that's nice dirt.
Days passed during the course of the year when their yards remained empty.
I missed them, missed seeing them when it was too cold for them to come out or when it was raining. Over the top! Yay!
When she said that she misses him, I had never known that. So, yeah, but I'm so happy they have each other.
When friendships form, powerful forces are engineered. Look no further than Mary and Benjamin, who built a bridge over 98 years.
You're going to hold my cane?
Boyd Hooper, Carol Evan News.
Okay.
Minneapolis.
Yeah. I've always thought grand people and little people are the best combination.
Yeah, they are.
They just get well together.
They do.
The G and Ursula Show, which begins at 9 o'clock. Geez, Scott. There has been a spike in violent crime in King County, as I'm sure you've heard. We had Hannah Scott talking about it earlier this morning. And now King County is taking a whole new approach from what I surmise. I mean, you've looked at this, G. $1.47 million to hire violence interrupters, as they're called, and $2 million, that's from King County, and Seattle spending $2 million on a variety of programs. I know agencies being funded is Community Passageways, which you're a big supporter of. So do you have hope that we're finally on the right path here?
Absolutely. I do have hope. Well, let's start how it's been before. Has that worked? Has it worked to throw a whole bunch of money into policing? Has it worked to consistently do the same things all over and again and get the same result? This is a different approach. I'm not saying that it's going to be something that's going to work tomorrow, but what I am trying to say that I'm trying to get folks to that I talk to understand the big picture part. So for an example, just keep it simple. When it comes to someone out there changing their ways, what would make someone change their ways? Let's just take theft. And let's just take maybe selling of drugs, right? And the reason why I'm using those two things, because those two things lead into other things. So for an example, when you have selling of drugs, somebody's getting money, somebody else isn't getting money, somebody else is upset, you have territory wars, all that stuff leads into that. But to simplify it, when you start talking about crimes with economic motives, if you have an opportunity to provide job training, money, supplies to help folks get into legitimate work, I have been fortunate in my life, and I don't know why I've had to live the life that I have, but I've been fortunate. What I mean by fortunate is I've been on both sides of this conversation, all the way up to, it's no secret, I lived in my car. Now, I was too scared to do other things, but let me tell you, do you think that I was desperate? Yes, I was, but I was so scared to do anything else. Now, growing up in Chicago, being around the projects where my grandmother lived, during that time, I'm telling this story to say that when you wake up every morning and you see no opportunity, but you see drugs being sold, and you see theft happening, and you see all of these things that you see, sometimes there's a possibility that that's the only way you see out. You don't see anything else. You don't see any other opportunity. So sometimes when I've gone back to Chicago and I've seen someone who is not on the streets anymore, not selling drugs anymore, I say, hey, man, what you doing? Oh, man, I got a good job, man. I don't want to mess that up. So I'll simplify it. The more we have an opportunity to give folks hope, the more we have the opportunity to give those job training and an opportunity, the better. Now, there's some people that are probably listening and saying, I don't get it. Why didn't you do this from the beginning? Why didn't you go to school? Hold on. There was a time in our country that if you were black, you couldn't even get into college. Right. So you don't think that that is going to have an effect going forward in the future? My grandmother only had an eighth grade education. My grandmother could not drive. These are things that have ripple effects. You don't fix those things overnight. And so with this idea, I don't know that it's going to be a guarantee to work right now exactly, because there's a lot of things that have gone wrong in the past. But this gives an opportunity for hope. This gives an opportunity for young men and young women to have these different chances to, again, get job training, get an opportunity to get legitimate work. When you get legitimate work, is great. Now, one of the biggest things that's happening in King County is affordable housing, livable wages. A lot of people can't afford to live where they grew up. That's a very frustrating thing. So anything to get better than what we've had, Dave, I'm on top of that.
And I reflect on my choices as a kid, which was who would pay me the most to mow their lawn in suburban Westchester County. Very different.
Right. How great is that, brother?
Yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, exactly. How great is that? And by the way, and for those that say, well, gee, you saw that? Yeah, I saw that. I was able to get picked up and go back home to my parents, where my parents were law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So you see what I'm saying? Like, I was able to live and see two different parts of the spectrum growing up. And I understand, like, a lot of my cousins who grew up in that, I understand why, where they are today and why, where their kids are today. It just is a ripple effect. At some point, it has to stop somewhere.
G. Scott with Ursula, 9 o'clock on Chiron. Thanks, G. New policing laws are taking effect statewide on Sunday. Let's go to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott for the details. Hannah.
Yeah, Dave, this is an update. Remember yesterday we talked about the new policing laws that are taking effect. This covers everything from de-escalation, mandatory decertification if cops don't follow the rules, when you can and cannot use force, various tactics that are now not allowed, limits on pursuits, and a lot of other things. There's quite a big significant change coming. And we've been hearing a lot of criticisms from law enforcement agencies, some law enforcement groups, some a little more extreme than others. We heard yesterday from Steve Strand with the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, who raised a couple of concerns really having to do with some vague language and contradictory statements in between bills. Here's one of the issues he explained.
A significant example is in House Bill 1054, which was sometimes called the Tactics Bill, that put restrictions on pursuits and certain types of equipment. There is a portion of that that says very clearly that firearms over 50 caliber are prohibited statewide. And that, you know, I think is intended to pertain to military rifles and those kinds of things, you know, large rifles, which again is understandable in terms of the prohibition. However, what is included in that then is sort of the large bore firearms that shoot beanbags, which are the less lethal tools that law enforcement uses to de-escalate situations.
So that's a problem because they're contradictory, because they're supposed to de-escalate everything, but they're not allowed to use those weapons. That was one thing. Yesterday, I got an opportunity in the afternoon to talk with Representative Jesse Johnson. He's the sponsor of several of these bills where the new laws are kicking in. And he shared this in reaction to some criticism.
I understand this is a shift for police as it relates to de-escalation and less lethal enforcement of the law. And I think a lot of our police officers actually understand that and they appreciate that. I think some of the misconceptions I'm hearing about the legislation is that it prevents law enforcement from responding to calls. The 1310 bill does not prevent them from responding to any calls or especially mental health crisis situations.
The 1310 bill, by the way, is the use of force limits bill. The other thing you wanted to clarify.
It actually asks police to use reasonable care when responding to the calls and to intervene and use physical force when necessary, when there's an imminent harm. And so the expectation is that law enforcement will continue to show up and respond and intervene and use de-escalation. It also does not prohibit officers from detaining someone who's in imminent risk of harm. What the bill does say is that there has to be an imminent risk. There has to be probable cause to use physical force on crimes that are not violent offenses. And when authorized to use force, to do it in a reasonable care standard. And so de-escalation, tactical questioning, creating time and distance, calling for backup when needed, and doing all those things before using force, and especially before using lethal force.
Well, so, I asked you this yesterday. Did we clear up whether the beanbags are covered or not?
So I'm glad you asked. Representative Johnson did say to me that there are a couple of issues, he admitted.
In House Bill 1054, we banned military-style weapons with .5 caliber or above ammunition, which does include some shotguns. In 1310, we say we want officers to use less lethal alternatives, and we provide a list of what those are, including beanbag rounds. What we did not know and what officers also did not catch or law enforcement did not catch in the legislative process is there are some shotguns that shoot those beanbag rounds. And so we'll have to go back and do a fix to allow for those shotguns that shoot the beanbag rounds.
Okay, so that's what I thought. Yeah, so this was a screw up. That's all.
Yeah. And you know, look, that sometimes happens with all types of legislation. They get a lot of stuff passed. They have to come back and make some tweaks in the following year. The other issue was the ITA, the Involuntary Treatment Act holds. That's, I've heard across the board from law enforcement that this is a big concern. We've got agencies coming up with rules. Some are going to send their officers on these. Some are not because of the way they're interpreting the law. These are situations where a designated crisis responder, this is a mental health worker, goes to assess whether someone needs to be involuntarily committed. Now, they have law enforcement with them generally because there could be a safety issue there for that behavioral health worker. But now, because of the way the laws are written regarding the use of force, as you heard Representative Johnson explain just a moment ago, there was concern that, you know what, we're not allowed to be here anymore. We can't use force on these people because of the new high standard. And Representative Johnson admits there's an issue there.
The threshold in the bill is there has to be an imminent harm or threat for officers to use physical force to move an individual or transport them or handcuff them. And the ITA, it says likelihood of harm, which is a lower threshold. And so we need to go back and reference the ITA and make it that lower threshold for officers to use physical force. That's definitely going to be a fix that we get worked out through legislation. And before that legislation, because obviously we have to wait to the session, we're going to work with the Attorney General's office to give some sort of indication that officers, you know, will not be held liable until that time we make the fix. And so that's the real challenge here, is that there's this gray area until we are able to make an ITA fix where officers feel like, well, we might be held liable for using physical force. And the Attorney General and us will be working to make sure that that's clarified and clear.
So to be clear, some of this stuff is going to have to wait for fixes in the legislative right. session. But that particular issue, and he really wanted to get this message out to all the law enforcement, is that you will not be held liable, which is a reference to being decertified. Right. You won't be in trouble for going ahead and using that lower threshold of likelihood of
well,
harm.
Good. So it sounds like this has been handled amicably. It was these were oversights, and they listened to the objections of police departments. And they're going to deal with them.
I mean, it does to some degree. And those are those two things that Representative Johnson just referenced are the issues that he believes exist. Beyond that, there's not a lot that he thinks is wrong. There are different law enforcement agencies. Clark County Sheriff's just put out a whole long list yesterday of massive criticisms of all of these laws, and they say that it will make officers and the community less safe. You hear that to some degree from the Snohomish County Sheriff as well. So different law enforcement agencies have different takes. I've talked to individual officers who are also concerned because their individual departments are coming up with their own interpretations of these rules, and they don't align necessarily with other departments. Everybody's kind of doing their own thing. So there's going to be some confusion. I think that's going to be an issue that ends up have to be addressed down the line. But again, these mental health holds, these ITAs, those were really the primary concern across the board. So those will be addressed very soon.
You're doing a great job on this. And I hope you, if you can, you know, bring us any more stories about how various police departments are seeing problems with this that will make people less safe. Let's air those and discuss them. Because what I heard there, even though I see there's still a difference of opinion, are two sides that are trying to hammer it out. Is that fair to say?
Yes, absolutely. Again, you've got the same kind of people on this that you had when I-940 was going through, right? Where you're really trying to get the collaboration and build that community trust between law enforcement and the community. However, these are extreme. These laws have been explained to me by some in law enforcement as the biggest significant shift to law enforcement in this state in the last 150 years, right? Yeah. So for some, it's different. But the people at the table, they are definitely trying to do this amicably.
Wonderful. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Boss, who's in for Colleen, and Chris Sullivan. Well, there is another episode in American history that needs a little reexamination, and that is the Battle of the Alamo. Jason Stanford, who grew up in Port Angeles, has taken this on. And what do you do for a living now, Jason?
I work for the school district here in Austin, Texas.
And your book is called Forget the Alamo, which is fighting words in Texas. When I was growing up, the Alamo was all about Davy Crockett and, you know, and Disney and John Wayne and Davy Crockett going down fighting. Yours is not the first book to rethink the Alamo story. When did people start having doubts that the Disney version was anywhere close to accurate?
Well, the Disney version was so popular that it imprinted on baby boomers indelibly. It started a bit in the 70s when someone dug up an old Mexican general's diary and discovered that Davy Crockett did not go down swinging, but surrendered and was executed the next morning, or later that morning, I should say. That caused national controversy. So there wasn't a huge market for looking at the Alamo myth again. It was only 5-6 years ago that the first academic history really firmly established that the Texas Revolt was motivated in large part by a desire to keep slavery legal in Texas. That was really late to the game.
And that's the heart of this book. This is about the entire motivation for the battle and what went on here. So we ought to do a little history. I mean, how Texas became part of the U.S. Originally, this was Spanish territory?
Originally it was Spanish territory. Texas was the outer reaches of the Spanish Empire about 300 years ago, and then Mexico won its independence and had a problem settling their northern province because the Comanches kept raiding them. And so they thought encouraging immigration from the southern United States would be a good idea. So they started giving away lots of land that was perfect for growing cotton to white southerners. And eventually they realized that there are a lot of white southerners in northern Mexico who weren't particularly interested in becoming Catholic or speaking Spanish or didn't care what they said in Mexico City. So they realized real quickly that they had an immigration problem in Texas. The Mexican government was inherently, one of their core values was being anti-slavery. But they were tolerating it in Texas to encourage the immigration that would protect them from the Comanches.
So to be clear, the Mexicans wanted the Americans to come in to develop this remote area, but the Americans were only going to come in under one condition, that they could grow cotton. And the only way they knew to grow cotton at a profit was to use slavery.
That's exactly right. And when they wanted to curtail American immigration into Texas, they started limiting slavery and eventually banning it altogether. And that's really what drove a lot of these cotton farmers to arms.
And that's who people like Jim Bowie and Davy Crockett and William Travis were supporting. The reason they fought the Mexicans was because the Mexicans were not going to allow slavery in Texas.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
I mean, that's a pretty important point. How did that end up getting scrubbed out of the story that we were all taught?
Well, the Battle of the Alamo, in which, of course, famously, about 200 white Texians, they were called, and some Tejanos were all killed. There were no surrenders were accepted. This was a horrible military defeat for Sam Houston's troops, and he had to turn it into propaganda really quickly. So what became a military blunder was turned very quickly into a motivation for revenge, which is how we get the phrase "Remember the Alamo." From there, it became the fodder for romantic amateur historians, and they just loved talking about the self-sacrifice. And, you know, these kinds of stories have been told forever. If you've seen the movie 300, you've seen a different version of this story.
Yeah.
Then it got caught up in Texas needing to tell its history not as a former Southern cotton slave state, but as a Western, you know, cowboy state. And so it became a revenge myth, and, you know, the slavery got scrubbed out of the history.
Okay, so when some of these other books came out using the diaries of the Mexican officers who had fought this battle, and people started finding out what really happened, what was the reaction in Texas?
Oh, it's traditionally been very, very angry. In fact, for all the anger we're getting, I think we might be getting the most positive response to any revisionist book about the Alamo. People used to get death threats. We've only gotten one, but another guy, Jeff Long, who wrote a book, a very scathing revisionist history of the Texas Revolution. You know, he had people coming to his house, and he needed police protection. People get very, very angry when you question the virtue of the Alamo defenders. And it's because this is the creation myth of Texas. And this goes to exactly why Texans think they're better than Iowans. because it's a little Christ story, right? These men selflessly gave themselves to certain death so that others may live. This is what Texans think of when they have to explain why they're special.
Yeah. Well, there are arguments that Americans, not just Texans, need little myth once in a while. In fact, I think, did you see Ross Douthat's column in the New York Times? About critical race theory. He's saying, ease up. We need some legends that we can look up to, and at least when we're children, and then we can teach the more accurate history later when the kids are grown up. Where do you come down on this? Do you feel that it is important to keep some legends, or does it have to be the whole truth, nothing but the truth, no matter what the psychological cost may be to the mindset of people who can no longer be quite as proud of their history?
You know, I'm okay. You know, there's no scientific proof that Jesus walked on water, but I have no objection to people going to church. There are a couple of problems, though, is when we use the power of the government to enforce this myth in education, as we do in Texas. It is state law that we require that seventh graders are taught that the Alamo defenders were heroic. We don't require the astronauts be taught as heroes or the allies in World War II. It's only the Alamo defenders. So this myth is written into law, and it causes a lot of confusion later in life when you do find out the truth. And for example, about half of Texans aren't sure who won the Battle of the Alamo. The myth overtakes the history so much so that we never actually learn the history. And there should be a way to teach history accurately and find heroes at the same time.
So this is state-sponsored brainwashing. This is interesting because there are people who really resent the idea that a state would mandate mask wearing. And yet we have a state that is mandating an inaccurate telling of history. And what do you think is the consequence when people grow up believing false history?
Well, they tend to start believing things like Trump won. And that the January 6th insurrection was just a bunch of confused tourists. You can make people believe anything if there is no agreed upon history or set of facts. And that's what's really dangerous about what we've going on now. We see this happening constantly. When you can't agree on simple things like election results and science and history, then people can be made to believe anything and you just can't get anything done.
Jason Stanford, the author of Forget the Alamo. Not all of this is bleak. There's actually a hopeful conclusion to our conversation. Vice President Harris met with DACA recipients, DACA applicants, and immigration rights leaders yesterday to assure them that the Biden administration is there for them.
This is your home, and we see you, and you are not alone. The president and I, we are unequivocal that we recognize you for the Americans that you are.
The program protects undocumented people who were brought to the U.S. as children and covers about 700,000 people, giving them legal status and the right to work. And that assurance ties directly to what I was discussing with author Jason Stanford, which we played in the last half hour. He co-wrote a book called Forget the Alamo, which documents that the defenders of the Alamo were actually defending slavery in Texas. Texas law actually requires seventh graders to be taught an inaccurate version of that story, which portrays the Mexican side as the bad guys. My question for Jason was, how do Hispanic parents whose kids are subject to this rule feel about this?
In the course of researching this book, we found that it was a very common experience for seventh grade Hispanic kids to go on the field trip to the Alamo, which is, it's happening every day there. And they go in as little Texans and they come out as Mexicans. They are taught that they are the bad guys in their own state, in a state that used to be theirs. And it is, they do one of two things. They either get or they get disinterested in history. The othering of Hispanics in this state is so pervasive that when I first moved here in 1993, I had fairly liberal friends call Hispanics Mexicans. They were all Mexicans, and they weren't trying to say that they were citizens of Mexico. They were just Mexicans. And it's just this deeply ingrained, othering, racist way of seeing Hispanics as second-class citizens in a state that used to be theirs.
Yeah. When their roots in the land are deeper than the Anglo immigrants who ended up settling.
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah. What the big shock to me was researching what happened after the revolution and after Texas became a republic. There's just no other way to call it. It was an ethnic cleansing. There were ranching families were dispossessed from their ranches and they became migrant workers. And they told that story to this day. Juan Seguin, who was one of the heroes of the Texas Revolution, became mayor of San Antonio, and he was run out of town because he kept deciding real estate disputes according to the law and not according to what the Anglos wanted. It was a nasty place here.
I'm just waiting for the next shoe to drop. I've just gotten used to the stuff that's been revealed in this whole debate over critical race theory, these race massacres, which were never touched when I went to school.
Yeah.
And now the Alamo thing, which was never – I mean, I had those little the only thing I knew about the Alamo was the you know those orange biographies that used to have in the school library, the biography of Davy Crockett.
Right.
That's what I read. This stuff, you know, didn't come within 10,000 miles of that book. So how, for people who are now finding their entire concept of American history being upended, what do you advise? How do we know who's telling us the truth?
Okay, well, first, you know, do your own reading. But second, I mean, all this information was out there. We didn't find new information about the Texas revolt and what happened after. There's been a ton of history about it. It's just going and reading the history, not the popular history, which is one thing. But also, I think we need to start telling a common story about America. And, you know, I'm a liberal, but I think liberals largely get the story of America wrong, where we say we are inherently sinful, right? That like our racist slave owning history, it means we are just built wrong from the beginning. And the conservative myth about a story about America is that we were born perfect, right? We're a great country. Both of those, I think, are wrong. I mean, the cheat code is in the Constitution. We are supposed to become a more perfect union. We have written into our founding document the mechanism for our continual self-improvement. We are a redemption story. We're not supposed to have gotten it right at the beginning. We're supposed to keep getting better. And that is what the history shows us, is that no matter where we started, we can still do better than that. And we have. And I think that is a story that doesn't divide us, and that brings us both together around the truth.
Jason Stanford, co-author of Forget the Alamo. Jason, great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.